Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhagen.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
And our world.
106.5
FM Los Angeles.
102.3 FM Riverside.
And 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the house of mystery. I'm Al Warren, and Mr. Dave Martino is here.
I am here.
So I'm drinking my Diet Coke Spice.
Oh.
Yeah. Are you
excited? I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's Spice.
Spice.
It's the new flavor.
Is that like Dune? Dune Spice? Or?
Dune Spice. Yeah, I'm so dry, you could have Dune. It's their new flavor. It's raspberry.
Oh.
Yeah, you don't sound that excited.
Yeah. No, I am.
Yeah, you're not. Have you seen Dune Part 2 yet or what?
I have not.
Waiting in the lineup.
No, I have not.
What's wrong?
I don't know.
Something wrong.
Haven't had a chance. Maybe, huh?
Your wife won't let you, right?
That's true. Yeah, that's it.
You can't see it.
If not, I'll watch it in 4K when it comes out on home video.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's
disc.
Yeah, it's kind of... It's all the same. I've been going through all the award nominees for Best Picture and watching them.
Oh.
And Poor Things is pretty weird.
Is it?
Yeah, I have to tell you. Yeah. You should watch it just for the sake of it. You should.
Okay.
It's a bizarre, but it's completely different than anything. And you can get through it, but it's not like any of the other ones that were nominated.
Okay.
And it is unique, I will say that. Hmm. But don't turn it off in the first 20 minutes, because I was tempted to a few times.
Okay.
Just so you know, you gotta
give it 20.
You gotta get through the first part, and then you can kind of get what's going on.
Okay.
You see, they don't really explain the weird stuff, but it's modern day Frankenstein in a way. Let's just say it that way. It's sort of, but it's weird. Yeah, it certainly is. I'd say definitely watch it, but there you go.
And let's give it some time.
There's my review.
Everybody's
waiting now. Now, speaking of all sorts of stuff, now we've got an author here who's got some books out, and we're going to talk about those. So, of course, the series we're going to focus on is he's got a four-book series, which is going to become larger in time, but right now there's four books, and it's the Luke in Time Mystery. So, Jody J. Sperling, thank you for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hopefully you say that in an hour. But so, Jody, first of all, I always like to know how a person finds themselves getting into the author world, because it's not really all it's cracked up to be. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of insane, the world of authors, especially with Amazon and all the weird stuff going on.
It's a lot like watching Poor Things, actually. The first, 20 years are really confusing. Nobody tells you what's going on. And then, you know, eventually you sort of settle in and there's a lot of nude scenes.
Yeah, exactly. You start figuring it out then. You start going, oh, now that's what it means.
Have you seen that movie?
Yeah, my wife and I just watched it this last weekend. And I thought it was really funny you brought it up, because we watched to the end, which is a practice I've gotten better at not doing if I don't enjoy something. Right. But literally, as the credits were rolling, I looked at her and I said, I don't think I liked that.
Yeah.
But it was just like, had to watch it. So.
Yeah, I had the same feeling. I mean, I was interrupted in the first 10 minutes, so I put it on pause, and then I went to it half hour later, and I watched a little bit, and then I stopped it. It was one of those that I did that through with the whole thing. And I don't know if I liked it or not. I don't know what to say to people other than, you should watch it.
Yes. It was with me through multiple days where I kept coming back and having conversations and being like, now, do you remember that part? Because was this what they were trying to say? And it was had a deep sticking point for me.
Yeah. And I think that's there was a lot of things in there that you were supposed to get. I'm still really kind of, I can't wrap it up in a complete sentence. I can't just say, this is what it is, because there's, I don't know what it was.
the closest I could summarize it in a sentence would be Wes Anderson for adults.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I'm just sort of, I don't know what to recommend or not recommend, or because all the other ones are pretty cut and dry. I can say, yeah, that was great, or this was no, I didn't care for that, or something. But this was kind of one of those that, you know what it was? It was something that I did not expect to see. How's that?
Yeah.
You know,
for sure.
It's just bizarre. So do you write like that?
This is a great question. I want to answer it honestly. What I think I do write like is, I got my Master of Fine Arts from Eastern Washington University, and so that required 6 years of education in the college system, and being told that people like Stephen King and all the hosts of very popular mainstream authors were hacks that wrote purple prose. And so I cut my teeth on folks like Dennis Johnson, Roberto Bolaño, David Foster Wallace, and Flannery O'Connor. And so I do think that even though I sort of uneducated myself from that teaching, that my prose and my character sensibilities probably still linger somewhere inside of the MFA world. And so it's weirdness. When you read one of my books, it probably feels reminiscent of Raymond Chandler in some ways. And I really don't mind spending some time developing a character, maybe even at the expense of developing the whodunit.
Right. Well, you know, we all learn from places. It's funny about MFAs and, and stuff. You know, I mean, I learned to write from reading Madonna's sex book 20, 30 years ago. And I've never had, the best prose I've ever had was in that book. But of seriousness, an MFA, does it really matter how good you write, as in the language? How do I say this? Like the grammar and all that? Or is it really the story itself and what it does to someone?
Yeah, so I think you're asking two really good questions that can't quite coexist in the world of the MFA. One is, something matters to them, and I to this day do not know what it is, because a lot of the students who get in are a little bit like me, where they arrive and they want to shine and they want to get the love of the professors and the program and make all of the connections and go on to be the next author of Cat Person, which, if you're not familiar, it's a short story that got a 7-figure advance for a young lady who was in her MFA around the same time, published in the New Yorker, and went on to completely bomb as a short story author. Her book didn't make back its advance even close. But all of us want that journey of like this big advance. And most of us somewhere along the way have teachers tell us like the things that you like are stupid. So you need to think differently if you ever want to be successful. Yes, good prose is important. Yes, good stories are important. And no, you'll never be told that you can do either as long as you're in school, because the school, I don't think, can make money if they tell you that you're good.
Right. Well, you know, because not only that, I mean, a lot of people base success on the dollars, right? The value of being a success, you know, creating something that all of a sudden you get like this $750,000 figure, and it's like, wow. Like, speaking of the best pictures, did you see American Fiction?
Yeah.
So isn't that kind of the same gist of it? You know, here's this guy that can really write, he's literary, and then he writes some garbage, you know, so to speak, and it becomes the big deal. And even though it's garbage. So but does that really matter? Like, McDonald's sells more burgers than anybody in the world. Is it really the best? Mm. Is it even close?
My goodness. I think it's such a good question. I don't even know if this is the question you're asking, but right in January, I recognized, like many people do at that time of year, that I wanted to make some changes to the way that I was living my life. And there's this sort of fad popular diet called the carnivore diet, where you eat only meat. And ironically enough, McDonald's is the only fast food chain that fits into that diet, because you can get their beef patties, and they don't have any kind of vegetable oil that they're cooked in, so they're all beef. So for like close to 60 days. One of my go-to places when I was out selling books for events and things was McDonald's. I would stop in, I would get 3-quarter-pound patties with nothing but just the patty in a little clamshell. And it sort of redeemed the chain in my mind in this weird way of being like, okay, here's like the enemy, and now they're a refuge to me. It's, how is this possible? What a weird world.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Dave's not on that diet, but that's all he eats. Oh, that's terrible.
But I'm not on any diet.
No. And
I'm on the it looks good, put it in my mouth.
Yeah. Eclair diet.
Yeah. That's the donut diet.
Yeah.
Part two. Well, it's just an interesting thing. That's what, you know, there's so many questions that we can get into, and there's so many things about writing and the whole experience of it. The good times, the bad times, all this stuff, the editing, the and selling the book and all that. But at the end of the day, it's about the process of writing. There's about something that you get out of writing a story. So the last question on process that I see is, was there a particular event or something that actually made you go, this is what I want to do. I want writing and I want people to see it. I'm going to publish it.
Okay. I want to keep this rather succinct, but after getting into the MFA, I wrote a memoir, and no, I'm not a 38-year-old with narcissism in the worst case sense. I lost the daughter. And when I lost her, I thought, like, the best way I know how to deal with this is to write a book about it. And I happened to be in my MFA at the time. I wrote it, and I was very proud of it. I got good feedback about it. And I met a New York author who teaches at the New School. And he said, this is so damn good. We got to get it out there. And so he gave me the name of an agent, and I sent it to the agent, and the agent kept it for months and months and months. And then she got back and said, you know, I really enjoy this, but I don't know that there's any commercial viability. And so she said no. And I was young. I was new to the business. I didn't understand that one rejection didn't mean something was still okay. So I kind of put it in a drawer and wallowed for a bit and started thinking, like, what's the next act? And I thought about the things I loved and what was compulsive for me, and mysteries were one of those things. And so I told myself, I'll write a mystery book. And I wrote a mystery book, and I went out and I got an agent with it. I had the literary agent, and she was pitching it all over the place, and we got some interest, and we had some conversations, and people were like, you got to cut chapter 7. There's a really dark scene in there. And I was like, yeah, but that scene is what the whole book's about, so I can't cut it. And I was new and young to the business, and so I demanded to keep the chapter until everybody walked away and said, we're not interested. So finally, 5 years later, I self-published the book, as was. And it has been an amazing journey. I think I did make the right choice. If I could go back and do it again, would I, like, cut chapter 7 and figure out how to rewrite the book and go commercial? Boy, that's a good question.
Yeah.
You don't get to go back in time, though.
No. I mean, there's always it's always a choice. And if you go commercial, sometimes you can take that commercial success and turn it back to doing what you want to do, because now all of a sudden you're established and stuff, so that's kind of okay. It's always tough, you know, you don't know. And so let's talk about the Luke in Time mysteries. So now you've completed 4 books so far, and what's the basic premise of this series of books?
So the main character is named Luke Emia. Lucia Emia is her full name, but she goes by Luke. It's a play on cancer. She says to people, you know, that she's not just called little cancer because she was born in July. And her partner, Lyle Kapochnik. And so she and he are deadbeat, no good private eyes who mostly get cases to find lost pets and cheating spouses. Then Marvin DeLonghi comes into their life and says, hey, someone's trying to kill me. I would love to hire you to find this person and rescue my life. And she doesn't give them very good information, but she offers a lot of money. So they take the case, they start to investigate, and quickly realize that they have walked into a trap. They end up dying, But instead of that being the end of the story, it really starts it. They go into a time loop. And then each subsequent book deals with an element of time, whether it's present, past, future, or some other kind of nuance of one of those three, to explore who this Marva DeLonghi person is and how they've gotten sort of stuck in her web. And so that's the premise of the whole series.
Did you come up with your characters, like your main characters, first and decide kind of how you were going to implement them in a story? Or did you kind of have the story outline and kind of create the characters to work in it? How did that go for you?
It's early on in the writing process when I first started with this, and actually Lyle came to me first. I had never even attempted to write from the point of view of a woman before, and so to fully answer that question, I would have to say there was a fellow classmate of mine in undergrad who was offended by my worldview at the time. I was a church-going Protestant guy who had just grown up that way and never really challenged my own thought process. He challenged me at the time because I really liked his writing, and so I was good friends with him. He challenged me, and he said, "Why don't you try to write a book, a story from the perspective of somebody who thinks the exact opposite of you? That would be really cool." So I started with that. Lyle came to me first because Lyle is, I would feel comfortable calling him very depraved, very controlled by his appetites, and yet super duper successful in everything he does. He's sort of like luckier than any person should be, and things just kind of come to him. I wrote a whole draft where he was the main character of the novel, and it never felt quite right, but I liked Luke an awful lot. And I realized, oh, that's actually the opposite of me. It's not just a guy who does horrible things. It's a woman who can do horrible things and exist in this world and be so successful and yet not have any moral compass in a sense. And that was really fun for me to do. So eventually when I figured out the tone and the story and everything, it was Luke who led it. So to answer your question after a little bit of rambling, it was character first, but I always had an idea of the story that I wanted to tell.
When you said that, you just said that, you know, Luke came to you first. So come to you. So how do you experience and work with your characters? Are you feeling them, seeing them, hearing them? Is it like a movie? How do you describe that process?
This is one of the most enjoyable experiences that I have ever had. They're not real, to be honest. Like at first, they're maybe a name or an essence or a sense. The more that I work with them, the realer they get. And so all throughout this process, as I was looking to get my literary agent, as I was looking to try to break out into the commercial world, I was looking to make my mark. I was thinking, what are the things that I can do that will give me a better chance of capturing someone's attention? And one of those things was actually creating a Twitter profile as the character of Luke E. Mia. She still exists at Luke E. Mia PI on Twitter. She doesn't tweet very often anymore because I have a fairly thriving and successful Twitter profile of my own. But I did that years ago because I thought, what if I were to tell a literary agent that this character has their own successful, thriving Twitter profile? I thought that that might give me some separation from the field. I think it did work. I think it's actually why Annie decided to represent me for that period of time, is because she really saw that I had a sense of marketing and a desire to do what it took. And what that led to was that I spent years tweeting as Luke and responding to people as Luke. And Luke has a very real picture of a woman. And so she looks real to everybody around her. And I never told anybody any different. I responded as if I were a female detective who was working living in Omaha. And by the time that I had gotten into full swing with this, there were people who thought that Luke was a real person. And it helped me to really flesh her out and understand who she was, to see her in my mind, have conversations with her. And so that was an incredible experience, and one that I think changed the way that I worked with characters forever.
Yeah.
When you're writing her, you're creating a Twitter for her, for Luke. What can you actually hear her? Do you have an inner monologue, and can you hear your prose? Is that how you write, or do you have some other way?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it is yes when. And I say that because when I am in the creative process, there is a true sense. And part of this is because I'm writing these books in the first person. And so when I'm in her voice, using the first person pronoun, I, me, my, I become her in a way that is really hard to describe, but is fully like in it. Like I am her when I'm writing her and I kind of lose myself. So I hope that that's not too like ethereal of an answer, but that really is what happens. When I walk away from the page, then I wouldn't even say I necessarily hear her. I do ruminate, like probably every writer does, on what comes next and what might motivate her to the next scene, what might upset her. I grieve when I know that I come upon a scene where I have to hurt her or do something that is going to separate her from her desires. And those things are typically felt in a much more separated way. But when I'm actually in the throes of writing, I would say that I am actually her.
Kind of like method acting.
Kind of, yeah, absolutely.
Wow. So do you have blocks of time that just go missing when you're doing these characters?
You know, I would say, and that's a good question. I like the tongue in cheek. So yes and no. I mean, I think I'm aware of time. I think I'm aware of place. Like I don't disappear into the fictional world of the dark streets of Omaha or anything like that. But, I do think that I can answer any question that you would ask Luke as if I was Luke.
Right. So how do you get into the mindset of a female and writing it in first person? That's interesting to, is there some sort of, do you have some sort of techniques or ways of doing that?
If I'm going to get canceled right here, then I guess let's go for it.
Oh, we're the canceled show, so don't worry about it.
I believe it. this really goes back to that friend from school who said, write the opposite of who you are. And so I just created a seed of a person who was the opposite of me. And when she appeared, I didn't have a sense, and I still don't to this day, that a woman is much different than a man. My wife and I regularly go for walks. We like to either walk our dog or just walk around the town with tumblers of delicious beverages that may or may not be okay for, you know, public consumption. And when we do that, we'll talk about all manner of different things. And I was saying to her the other day that there is something distinct about men and women. I have a lot of testosterone, and that has a massive effect on the way that I think about the world, the way that I behave, my aggression, so many things. There's no question in my mind that there is a fundamental difference between men and women. And yet, we are also completely reversed in the roles that we have. She's stereotypically non-emotive. She wants to solve problems. She works with power tools. I could go on and on and on. She fits the stereotype of the opposite gender, and I kind of fit the stereotype of like, hey, turn by the large tree over there. And I just want you to listen to me right now because I am feeling sad. You know, that's my stereotypical behavior. So I think that there's less that distinguishes who we are than we think there is. And so to write from the perspective of a woman really just required me to think as best as I could, what would it be like to be a woman, until I sort of inhabited that space. I hope that's a good answer. I feel a lot like I'm rambling.
No, but, it's just, you know, yeah. Even at my best. Yeah, you're giving your thoughts, you know. So now you consider this detective mystery and hard-boiled. So do you tend to have raw and violent, thrilling scenes, or, you know, sex and all that stuff, or do you keep that tone down? Like, how do you approach writing violence in your book?
There's an author that I think is really amazing. His name is Robert Olin Butler. He won a Pulitzer Prize for fiction, and his violent scenes, especially, he writes a detective series that's kind of set during the World War II era, and I love the way that his fight scenes and intense scenes sort of just like roll on top of you, and they just kind of like hit so hard. So I think that I tried to emulate his style, where there's not a lot of periods. There's very few commas. You use the language itself almost to be like violent and all at once, just coming and pouring out on you. So I use a lot of violence in my books. And oftentimes when I do, I write fairly long passages of very graphic explanation. And I've heard from readers that it's a lot of fun to have that experience of just the violence, like pouring out on you. As far as sex goes, that goes back to the earlier comment about the book not ever getting a commercial publisher. Chapter 7, this is as close to a trigger warning as I'll ever give, but Chapter 7 at the end, Luke is raped graphically. And it's very, very important to the book, but I do not spare the reader. It's not gratuitous, and it's not glorifying, but it is graphic. So I think that probably answers how I deal with all of it.
Right. So are you thinking about the reader when you're writing then? Are you thinking, are they over your shoulder while you're putting it together and kind of going, and you're thinking, oh, how are they going to react with this? What are they going to think of this? Or do you not think about that?
No, I do. Yeah. I recently got into a fairly enjoyable, robust conversation where people were very angry with me for my stance on this. But I tweeted that any author who seeks solely to entertain is failing their reader. And most people ignored the solely part and accused me of not wanting to entertain my audience and said, like, how dare you ever call an author a failure? Like, anybody who writes a book is already a success, which I disagree with that statement. And I also disagree with anybody who thinks that, like, entertainment in and of itself is enough, because we're trying to do more. Any movie that we watch, any book that we read, any play, any music, any experience we have is multi-layered. And I think a lot about what I want my readers to feel, how I want them to experience, where I want them to be along the journey. And I do my very best to honor them by subverting expectations at every turn while still entertaining them to the point that they do feel a little bit like poor things, where they're like, wow, that is rough. That's hard. Oh, I don't know if I was expecting that. I don't know if I wanted that. That is somewhat pleasurable to me, to have that sense of, like, I almost betrayed what you thought you were going to get. The big difference I would say is, if I'm succeeding, and I don't know that I always am, but if I'm succeeding, you get to land in a place that is very gratifying. So that final taste is quite sweet. That's my hope.
Right. And so when you say that, do you mean that you actually have a subtext or a meaning or some sort of thing that you want the reader to take away from the book, besides the joyride, the entertainment, the thrill and all that stuff and the storyline? Is there something underneath that you're hoping they take away?
I can't commit to saying, yes, I want them to take away a specific thing. But I can tell you that when I write, I am writing toward questions. And so going back to the friend in school who said, write the opposite of you. I ended up walking away from my faith because of writing that book and writing that character and starting to see the world from the perspective of somebody who would be critical of the church. I still believe in God. It's a very different thing. And I realized, like, I took a lot of damage growing up in the church. And so I decided I don't want my kids to grow up in the church, because it very easily could happen. And in fact, I've watched things like that happen to my kids in the few years that they were alive and going to church with us. So when you say, like, do I want them to take away something? I don't think so, but I do want those questions to register at the unconscious level and impact the way that they experience the world. And that is a true desire that I actually try to succeed at when I write a book. So I'm not trying to make somebody a Democrat or a Republican or a racist or a chauvinist or an anti-racist or anything like that. But I might possibly have questions about, like, what does it look like to be a strong man who is a feminist as well? or I might have questions like, what does it look like to believe in morality and not necessarily affiliate with a church? So those questions probably show up and impact what I'm writing, but they're not like the moral or the theme of a book.
Right. Well, and sometimes it happens organically. Sometimes it just happens within the story, right? It's not like, I want to make sure I get this point across. Sometimes just doing the story creates a point or a thought, like you said, and then that's, in essence, what it is. Evil characters, the bad people, the people that are causing havoc in the stories, you know, or the killer or whatever the case is. How do you get into that mindset? And do you have any qualms writing that kind of person?
I love writing the baddies. I feel like we're in a moment right now where you've got like Breaking Bad and The Sopranos and all those kind of shows where we have seen the bad guy take on roundness and depth. And I'm certainly a product of this generation where if the bad guy, him or herself is not extremely compelling, then I probably don't want to spend the time doing them. Yes, I find it wearisome sometimes to indulge that part of myself, but it might also be because I really enjoy the idea of breaking rules and doing terrible things.
Right. Would you get into them just like the other characters? Like Luke, for instance, compared to one of your bad characters, are they kind of equal in experience to you when you're doing it?
Yeah, pretty close. I know Marva very, very well. I have so many things written from Marva's perspective. She's not a first-person character in the series. She's always experienced from the perspective of Luke, who is the first-person narrator for the whole series. But I know Marva so well because she is kind of like the big baddie of the whole series. And to know her and to really indulge myself in understanding her motivations it's great. It is hard. Like I said, it is actually challenging, but it's also really rewarding. She has such a crooked way of viewing the world and the things that she wants. And I think that there's a grain of goodness. Maybe goodness isn't the word I want here, but there's a grain of honesty in the way that she views the world that I think is what's so compelling to me about her. She's come across her perspective and made some poor conclusions, but she wants something that most of us want. And if I say more than that, I feel like I spoil a bit too much.
Right.
Well, how do you handle the PIs in this book? Do you take a lot of liberties, or do you try to stay in line with the reality of private detective work and do a lot of research?
Okay, so this is a both-and question. I have a very good friend. His name is John Hoda. He writes great books. He is a lifelong private investigator. And I seek him out always to make sure that my private eyes are grounded in real research. They actually live in and investigate in the city of Omaha, Nebraska, which is where I've spent much of my life. And I really try to ground the offense of the book in the reality of Omaha, Nebraska. I don't try to stretch that too much. And so very much of what they do is based in reality, and the liberties that they take are based in the actual handbook of private eyes, which John has actually written a handbook of how to be a successful private eye, everything from how to get errors and omissions insurance to how to make money and get the right cases, which cases to take and deny and all that kind of stuff. And so I've had great and fruitful conversations with John over the years to make sure that what I'm doing is believable and accurate to private eyes. I also write fiction, and there happens to be magical elements, like people die and then come back from the dead and live in a time loop. And so there are these things in the book that are very unbelievable because they're, you might call it fantasy. It might be categorized as a very light version of urban fantasy. But the actual investigating piece, I try as hard as I can to be accurate. Yeah.
You mean you don't come back after you die? That's not real?
Not that I know of yet.
Wow.
Working
I'm
on
losing
it.
That. I didn't. That's news. Well, your setting then. Your setting sounds important. So the setting and the area and location and stuff. So are you writing it as if it was a character in itself?
Yeah. If you were to look at my outline right now for the next book in the series, many chapters start with things like the weather and the lighting. And I say, write this scene as if it is a character. And that's always a prompt to myself to remember, slow down, let the place itself be part of the mood, set the tempo, those kind of things. And so, yes, yeah, I want the place to be a character of a sort.
Right. And I also see, so because now you've got four books and you're going to do more. So is this in your mind series? Have you had it outlined ahead of time? You kind of know where you're going, where it begins to end, and how many books you're going through, yeah. And then you're kind of filling it in as you go? Or is this something that is completely ad-libbed, no thought into it at all? How do you do a series?
Yeah, so at this point, I have a document that outlines the beginning and the major points along the road. I have another document that briefly describes each book. And as I get into the book that I'm working on at the time, the first thing I do is I create, I've been calling it an outline. I'm also told by people who really actually outline that what I'm doing is not outlining, but writing in brief. My first draft is somewhere in the range of 20,000 words, typically. It's what I call the outline, but it's about 20,000 words, and it encapsulates every single chapter. As I start to build the novel, I consult the outline or the first draft to make sure that I'm hitting all the high points and getting all the details in. And that's because as you start to build a series this big, especially when the books are interconnected, it's really important to know that I'm not going to contradict earlier events or change the path of future events.
Right. So in a way, it's kept almost like a series Bible. It's almost like something you can refer to as you go along, because you don't want to get the eye color wrong or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's the worst thing in the world, because readers will catch that.
Yes, absolutely. And there actually are a couple of things now that serious readers have questioned, which is nice, because I think you get to do multiple editions of books. And there's nothing hugely that violates, but there's a couple I know of where people said, you might think about that. And that's nice. You have, like, unbiased readers who are really enjoying the series.
I wonder, too, do you also kind of take into account some sort of research outside of the PI, for instance, but just with what you're doing and how you're doing it and the time, like if you said people come and go and stuff, how much research do you put into developing the basic info in the book?
Maybe a little bit less intentional research in that aspect, because I wanted to make Omaha so important to this series. I get a little bit tired of California and New York getting like all the attention. And I think places like Omaha really have a lot to offer. And I remember in undergrad, I had my advisor. She was upset with me and said it'll never work because I had a scene in downtown Omaha and I referred to it as the Old Market, which is our spot in downtown. She used to be an editor for Time magazine before she taught at my university. And in her mind, you couldn't write about the Old Market because people wouldn't understand what that means. And I thought, like, yeah, but they don't understand what Tribeca means either. You just use names. And so as far as research goes, it has much more to do with what I steep myself in. And then that stuff sort of infiltrates the fiction that I write.
Right. Now, your accessory characters, all the minor characters that fill in and come and go throughout the series and stuff, where do they come from for you? Is it people you know or people influenced you, like people maybe you went to school with or you saw at a coffee shop? How does that come along?
I have a bit of a bad habit, and I probably am too indulgent occasionally, but I really like wordplay. So I have a family of very minor accessory characters that all have, like, the wordplay. Like, one of them is named Rinse Shower Off, and, like, if you see it spelled on the page, you might not even know how to pronounce it necessarily, but I really enjoy taking, like, a name and having it be an element of wordplay. Typically, that's a big piece of minor characters is some kind of wordplay, some kind of like, oh, you know, haha, LOL, this character has a silly name. And then the other bit is I really like for minor characters to do heavy lifting. And so I frequently will make a minor character absurd to a tilt that makes them memorable if they just appear in one scene, like doing something that normal human beings can't very often. And that's my goal, is to have those like bit players be memorable for how silly they are.
Right. And so who have you killed off in real life in your book? We want names and phone numbers, because we're going to get them on the line right now and talk to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's have them call in. We'll hash it out. No, you know, I have a character later who I'm really looking forward to slaying in a terrible way. He was a boss of mine before I left the W2 world that took extreme pleasure in humiliating me in public settings. The company that we were working for, his company bought my company. And so I think it was a bit the culture to just kind of like let those people who had been purchased understand that they were losers. And it was really humiliating. And there was no way. I would tell my wife sometimes, I would be like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. And she'd be like, well, the paycheck suggests you better figure it out.
So. Right. Right. Well, we'll have to get that person on.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about social media, website and stuff like that. How do people find you? Do you like readers to interact with you in different places? Give that out.
Yes. Okay. So just today, and there's a bit of a separation here. So I have a podcast called TRBM. It used to be The Reluctant Book Marketer, but I wanted to be able to expand beyond just book marketing a little bit. I had a guest interview with Stephen Pressfield, author of The Legend of Bagger Vance and The War of Art. Really amazing guy. That one dropped today. My website is www.jodyjsperling.com. All of my books are available there. And then anywhere that you can find me on social media, I'm fairly active, maybe not the most, but would be at Jody J. Sperling. And so I've been very consistent making sure that it's the same across social medias. I'm most active on X/Twitter.
Excrement.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Well, you know, we'll have all that up on our website too. People can find it then easily in one click.
Perfect.
And so what's next? What's going on now? What are you working on now?
All right. Well, I have a very diabolical plan, and I think it will work. So I'll tell you here first. I wrote a novel called Kidnapping George Clooney, and I am going to get it all edited up and looking beautiful. I'm going to pay for editors and proofreaders and all that kind of stuff so that it would be fully self-publishable, but I'm actually going to try my hand at the traditional publishing world again. I mentioned earlier Robert Olin Butler. He and I have had the opportunity to talk. That's a whole different story, but a really awesome hack in the matrix, really. And he happened to get an agent named Peter Steinberg, who I also know. And so I'm going to be sending it to Peter and hoping that that small connection will maybe give me one more chance at publishing traditional. Now that's what I'm up to next. So hopefully we'll be able to talk in the future and say, oh, look, I actually achieved my original goal.
Yeah. Yeah, hook me up with Clooney. No,
yeah, exactly.
Well, I appreciate it. So now, of course, the series of books we're talking about is the Luke in Time Mysteries.
Yes.
Four books, and the guest is the author of those and many more. So Mr. Jody J. Sperling, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jody.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.